You know what the great houses fear most, Dr. Kynes. Exactly what has happened to us here. And Sardaukar coming and picking them off one by one. Only together can they stand a chance against the Imperium. Would you bear witness? Testify that the Emperor has moved against us here.
If they believe me, there would be general warfare between the great houses and the Emperor. Chaos across the Imperium.
And suppose I presented the Emperor with an alternative to chaos. And the Emperor has no sons, and his daughters are yet to marry.
You'd make a play for the throne. The Emperor feared the Atreides. He brought you here to kill you. What don't you understand? Your lost boy hiding in a hole in the ground.
Fremen speak of the Lassan al-Ghaib.
Careful.
A voice from the outer world who will lead them to paradise.
Superstition.
I know you loved a Fremen warrior and lost him in battle. I know you walk in two worlds and are known by many names. I've seen your dream. As Emperor Dr. Kynes, I can make a paradise of Arrakis with a wave of my hand.
Hello, welcome to the Extra Credits Plus of
My Arrakis, My Dune.
My Dune.
I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
So today is our reaction to Dune Part 2 and our deep dive of Dune Part 1.
Yeah.
This will be a truly massive episode. We just got out of our third viewing of Dune Part 2, and we have gone on quite the journey to the point where I feel like I watched or had three different experiences at all three showings in the past week.
That's how I felt with Dune Part 1.
I know.
Also, right? Like, we've had such different experiences with...
Very odd.
The movies. And, I mean, they're massive, so it makes sense, especially since we haven't read the books.
Where I'm at with Part 2 right now is that it's really, really good. Like, really good.
Yeah.
If not...
It's great.
Great, yeah. It is a direct continuation of Dune Part 1 thematically and narratively. But where Part 1 was this atmospheric, careful, and cautious, I think, character study and this massive exercise in world building and lore, Part 2 tries to transform the Duneverse into something loud, thundering, sharp politically, and arguably even more like sociopolitically transgressive than the first movie, and very transparent about some things, almost to a fault in moments. And there is, I think, a lot to explore about the greater Duneverse today. And Denis Villeneuve too, one of our favorite filmmakers, who somehow consistently finds intimacy in the grand, in the spectacle, where I think his peers, or even his, like, you know, his favorite filmmakers of all time, who also play in large scope and scale, often struggle with trying to find what makes sometimes spectacle deeply tragic, ironically. And he tries to find like these human stories at the heart of epics, and Denis is so good at that. So these two films, they're massive. Sometimes they're overwhelming, but ultimately they're major accomplishments. And they both still have flaws, and we'll get into those flaws. You know, but they both share some issues.
Yeah.
But I think, especially in Part 2, there's more to talk about in terms of the scale, but also in terms of the bigger problems.
Yeah, I agree.
But I do think these Dune projects hold the medium to a higher standard when it comes to big budget studio events. So this is going to be like a praise podcast for the most part.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you said, there are things to be critical of in terms of, you know, themes that aren't as developed as I think they should be. That mostly has to do with Part 2 for me personally. But we will also talk about why we think Denis is probably the perfect filmmaker to tackle such a massive story like Dune.
Yeah.
It's like his whole filmography has been building towards this, right? And we've covered his filmography on the podcast, and then also like some of our favorites, like the scope of Blade Runner that's in Dune, and kind of the careful, quiet character studies like Arrival, or, you know, his other movies like Prisoners.
Sure.
Symbolic, you know, aspects of his filmmaking.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about how Dune Part 2 is being described as bigger and better than Part 1, because I don't disagree that it is louder, right? It is more so an action movie. And I don't mean that like pejoratively, right? It is a great action movie.
Arguably like a legendary scope and scale action film.
Yes. But I think that part one and part two are just very different movies. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they are part of like the same larger story, but part one is more so a slower paced, right? Mm-hmm. Political family space drama.
Almost like a melodrama in moments. Yeah.
Yeah. And then part two is like, we were saying, like an action movie. It's more so similar to what we are used to when we watch a historical epic.
Sure.
Right. With like Braveheart or something. Yeah. Right. And so I think that it's interesting to see like which one people prefer. For me personally, I prefer the first one.
I agree.
I think we'll talk more about the different like choices that are made when tackling these massive themes that Dune sets out to look at, right? Like it's looking at how power operates at large, looking at religion mm-hmm. as an ideology, as a form of power.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at the white savior complex and archetype and trying to deconstruct that we see in like Western media and narratives.
Yeah.
And then it's also looking at the idea of like empires and how power functions in terms of colonialism and imperialism. And those are like massive things to have even like in a basically 5-hour movie.
The biggest of ideas.
Yeah. So, but I think I prefer like the first one and how it goes about looking at those character studies.
Yes.
Even though I respect the second one in being very direct about what he's trying to say with this story. But I do prefer part one.
They're both subversive movies, right? They're both subversive in how they are trying to, or Denis is trying to lure the audience in and then twist some of their expectations.
Yeah.
But the second one in particular has a real challenging job because it's playing in a genre that most Western audiences view as the most spectacle driven idealist genre, which is like action films that then play in like a dry or sometimes kind of like inappropriate sense of humor that you usually see in like maybe even a 2005 action movie, you know, and that has moments of Dune Part Two where you're like, what is Villeneuve doing here? And you don't really realize what he's doing until the very end.
So unlike the rest of his filmography, it feels.
Yeah.
We'll talk about those moments today for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that. So just so listeners know, we're going to be discussing, again, part two, our reaction to it, just our relationship to the Duneverse, and then today will mostly be a deep dive of part one. So if you don't want anything spoiled and you haven't seen part two, you got to go watch that immediately because we are going to be spoiling part two a bit today.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have an IMAX...
The biggest screen possible.
Yeah. If you don't have an IMAX near you, at least look for like some Dolby sound system, an AMC or a Regal, wherever they kind of have those, because it is worth it. And I do think that this movie is going to be an event, and I think it will probably get close to $1 billion at the box office. And if you're a listener who's like, well, that, who cares? Like that just is like a commercial... spectacle, like what does that matter? For a movie to be this political and be supported by mass audiences, this is exactly what Hollywood needs to transition into. Get out of like 80s escapism that we're kind of like slowly moving toward, or quickly, I guess you could argue, and then go to movies with actual stakes that are provoking at a high level to the contemporary world.
Yeah.
And Denis using sci-fi in this way, I mean, just makes me really excited to be a fan of sci-fi, because this is what makes the best sci-fi special, is trying to connect these worlds that are 20,000 years into the future to what you're seeing in front of you, to really make you go home at night and almost feel like you had an anticlimactic experience, because it's kind of a depressing film, which is what part two feels like.
And there are like elements that you can understand what Denis is trying to do in certain parts of Dune Part Two. If you've seen like Blade Runner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of questions that he's interested in. So, yeah.
He's done this before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're new to the show, this is our second episode of Villeneuve Month. We've discussed in length why we love his work and visual and thematic ambitions. Specifically, we have deep dive, like Kelsey said, Prisoners on the feed back in October, I think.
Yeah.
And then we did Blade Runner 2049 last month, and or earlier last month, as those are probably our two favorite Villeneuve movies,
mm-hmm.
respectively. I think for me, it's Prisoners, and then for you it's 2049.
Oh, are we doing this
right? I think so.
Yeah, no,
for our
I think
favorite
so.
Not what we think is necessarily his like most important film,
yeah,
which arguably is Dune.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, so Blade Runner is my favorite, but I do think that Dune is like up there, and I can't tell which one I think is like, which I like more because it's better made or the themes.
Yeah, Yeah. I need some time. I need some time to think about Dune, especially after realizing that Denis was not kidding. Part one and part two is really just one movie. I really wish the Alamo Drafthouse or some theater chain would have allowed us to watch Dune part one and part two back to back for the Dune heads, like, the real Spice heads,
you know, like,
yeah, you're right. Gremlins around like the holiday time.
Yeah.
I would have totally watched these movies for 5.5 hours in a theater. That would have been so sick. So one day they'll probably let us do that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to start our discussion by unpacking our relationship to the Duneverse.
Okay.
Seeing as people are calling this our new contemporary Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. epic new cinematic franchise. And seeing as we have been so openly like Denis Villeneuve heads for so long now, and that we've never talked about Dune on the show, I'm sure some of our listeners are like surprised.
Yeah.
And that's because we just didn't know anything about Dune before 2021. Like, we never read the Frank Herbert novels. I had never seen the David Lynch movie.
I haven't either.
And I'd never seen any of the adaptations after that, like the TV series or the documentary about the movie that was never made, and how Dune has been this like highly challenging adaptation that Hollywood has just traded rights to. And also, as like a student when I was in school, I thought Dune and Lord of the Rings as novels in the fantasy genre were really just not my lane. And also, they were so dense looking, and that overwhelmed me as a kid.
Yeah, I was definitely intimidated, I think.
I mean, I remember being wowed by the Peter Jackson franchise, like the movies, and then trying to check out Fellowship of the Ring, and I was like, I'm good. There's like 5 pages on like movement of grass.
Yeah, I got the movies, yeah.
Yeah, and so... You know, and also I think we're inundated by Chosen One stories or twists on hero narratives like Harry Potter or Anakin Skywalker or Neo, or even those weird like dystopian trilogies we were getting like one after another, like Hunger Games, Divergent, Maze Runner.
Yeah.
Our generation just had so much about like ecological disaster and these people who might be flawed characters, might be anti-heroes, might be reluctant heroes. And it's like, okay, we kind of get it. And that's kind of how I treated Dune, which is that I was like, okay, this is this faraway text. It's a massive, fantasy trilogy.
It's a big time investment is like how I saw
such a it. Massive investment. And I was wrong. I thought I was like, okay, I have The Matrix. I have Blade Runner. I understand what the Dune is probably trying to say. But I was like 15 thinking about hero arcs and conventions. And I was like, I'm good. I don't need this one. So we never read Dune, but I'm also kind of glad I didn't, because I wouldn't have had this volatile but very interesting experience with the movies.
Yeah.
Because coming into Dune Part 1 in 2021, not knowing the lore, but knowing that Frank Herbert's work inspired all of my favorite science fiction and fantasy movies and franchises, mm-hmm. and knowing that Herbert was also inspired by the rise and fall of empires throughout history and the use of religion and politics in this like futuristic intergalactic chess game, I was really excited to see, okay, what is it Denis find fascinating about Dune? Why does he call Dune Star Wars for adults? Which I think is, I love Villeneuve, but that's a shitty thing to say, but funny. And I was excited to see it on screen because it had been unadaptable to that point. It was Villeneuve, and it was kind of cool to go into Dune sort of blind to the major through lines and the political and religious machinations. And I also was fascinated by George Lucas being criticized inverting the Paul arc with Anakin, because I thought Anakin was such a fascinating character, and I still do. But then watching Paul and Dune, you kind of understand why Dune fans were pissed off by Anakin Skywalker and maybe the lack of interrogation of that character in the Star Wars cinematic universe. So watching this like sympathetic and like seemingly progressive humanist figure like Paul in the first movie fall into this messiah trap and then becoming like this like dangerous sociopath has been fascinating. And I wouldn't have had that like experience of tension and mystery and suspense when it came to how self-aware Dune was if I had read the book. So I'm in this weird place where I'm kind of glad I didn't check them out.
I mean, I feel the opposite. I feel like, why didn't I read this book before?
Okay, yeah.
And I did get it on Audible. Okay.
Nice.
It's a summer project for me.
Are you going to go like 1.5 speed on that?
I mean, yeah, I listen to all podcasts on like 1.5 is my lowest. And that's not like me
lowest.
Being like, wow, I can listen to things fat. I just like, I obviously have a problem where like I get bored from listening to 1.0 speed.
I think
so
it's a skill.
That's a me thing. But yes, yeah, so I'll listen to it on speed probably. But I think that I wish I had read it before. Because I was like, oh man, if I mean, like you said, we did have all those chosen one kind of deconstructing the hero narrative.
Yeah.
And I think we're actually kind of lucky to have that generationally, even though there were a lot of kind of like popcorn-y,
sure,
blockbuster teen dystopian movies like you were talking about with Hunger Games and Maze Runner. But those movies did give our generation a language to kind of understand exploitation, mm-hmm, and like class.
Yeah.
And I think those are underrated for that because they're kind of, you know,
yeah,
like, yeah, they're not masterpieces.
I mean, they're sensationalist, but also, yeah, like the new generation has claimed Hunger Games because they have nothing, yeah, like it, and they,
that's
like
true,
want to be in that world, and they, yeah, think the text is fascinating.
But so, I think like what I've always wanted in a big genre movie, and like we love sci-fi and we love dystopian movies, is I've always wanted something that kind of tackles like empires and religion,
mm-hmm,
and you know, Star Wars obviously does that in like certain aspects, but I've always like,
sure,
and obviously what they did with Luke and like, mm-hmm, in the newer movies that everyone got upset with, like the Jedi Order,
the Last Jedi specifically.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's sick,
that's the closest, right, we ever get to Dune,
yeah,
is Rian Johnson's film. Yeah,
right. So I was like, oh, I wish I like, you know, had that text and that story, and I even like going into looking at certain like just YouTube videos to understand what is the Space Guild, because,
yeah,
we'll talk about it in Dune 1, but when the herald, the Emperor's herald, like comes and says, you know, I'm with the Space Court and the Space Guild, I was like, who are these orange yeah, like, you know, space people?
Yeah.
And I just did a like a quick like wiki, you know, uh-huh, how like,
is there a Dune wiki?
There's a Dune wiki, like every other, yeah, like, yeah, lore. But I was like, oh, wow, okay, these people like control the spice. That's so interesting. It's not even touched on in the Dune lore. Like, I want more. So, but I think actually what you're saying, I am grateful in certain senses because like, obviously we already like think about these themes. I think that's why we like love this movie, mm-hmm, for it, putting it in a sci-fi genre movie that's like so epic.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have had the same experience of being like, huh, it's interesting how they're able to really like shape Paul's character,
yes,
getting audiences to maybe, you know, connect to Timothy Chalamet, right?
Exactly.
And subvert the audience's expectations. And should we be connecting to this figure, right?
Yeah.
This like prince. So I really did enjoy my experience so much more because I didn't know the lore.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, moving forward, I'm just so excited to read the books and like kind of figure out more about this world. Although I will say, you know, people who like love like rereading Lord of the Rings and rereading really dense sci-fi texts, like, mm-hmm, that's awesome. I sometimes do, like you were saying, like I get kind of like, oh, like let's keep going.
Yeah. I mean, we have a movie, you know, podcast. So yeah, like we love 2.5 hour tight, concentrated adaptations of like deep novels often.
Yeah.
And so like that makes sense.
I don't
sense
need like
that we
every
need...
detail. So I'll, yeah, let listeners know how my journey goes with the Dune.
Yeah.
Reading.
We'll have to, maybe we'll have a summer episode and I'll,
yeah,
clear out and you can just,
I'll just,
you know,
update,
go crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's our relationship to Dune prior to 2021, which I guess is absent.
Which is not, yeah, knowing it existed.
Yeah.
I think that it's a good time then also to say that this is probably an interesting podcast for many listeners who have different relationships to Dune, right? Like for people who are like us and haven't read or watched it,
yeah,
before, like you'll be able to kind of like relate to us and maybe our experience, and maybe you had a different one, like that's cool,
mm-hmm,
for seeing this story for the first time. But also I personally think it's interesting for people who know the Dune lore to see like how people who are just coming to the story for the first time,
mm-hmm,
and not having all that background maybe understand the movie, like what wasn't developed, what was, like our understanding. I always know like when I am really, I mean, that's why I love like watching people's reactions to seeing like a TV series or like a,
yeah,
movie that I,
like,
haven't
the Red
seen
Wedding or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, I'm like, I want to see how people come to this story that I really love. So hopefully it's interesting for you there too. But I will say for people who are already longtime Dune fans, you know, Dune isn't like just yours, you know, like I know sometimes people feel this way. If we mispronounce something, if we say the wrong name, if we mess up a part of the lore, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, what's really annoying is like,
that's not what the sand compactor,
yeah,
that's
does. Not what, yeah, it's like correcting us, which luckily I don't think we've ever had anyone do that. Which is, Great. Yeah. Yeah, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
People have been angry about our rankings before, but never about lore.
Yeah. But you know, if we do mess something up or we do like have, you know, something that we didn't get right about the lore, like let us know. You can, you know, DM us or whatever in a nice educational way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm
saying? Let us know in the Spotify Q&A. Yeah. Let us know somewhere.
Yeah.
So let's go through our journey with Dune. So Dune Part 1 released in 2021. At that time, we didn't know it was Part 1. We just thought it was Dune.
Yeah.
And we knew it was Denis. And we're like, yeah, we're down. We have no idea what this movie's going to be about, but we've heard about the Messiah story, so maybe it's about that. And it came out during the pandemic, which was obviously a challenging time for film. And it still ended up being like critically acclaimed, commercially successful, mm-hmm. nominated for 10 Oscars, making $400 million. And I think it was safe to say that at that point, Denis Villeneuve was not a household name.
Yeah.
By kind of just, you know, common moviegoers might not know who he is at that
right.
point.
Yeah. I feel like people were familiar with maybe Arrival or some of his other movies. But yeah, like at large, I'm not sure people knew Denis Villeneuve's name and the way that they'd probably do now with like Dune. I think it is a name making movie. Just how kind of Christopher Nolan with his career, I feel like his name making franchise was Batman.
Especially The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this will be that moment for Villeneuve, Dune Part 2 specifically. I actually think Timothy Chalamet in 2021 was probably a bigger name than Denis Villeneuve. So it is his most important movie to mass audiences at this point. So until a month ago, when we saw the IMAX reissue of Dune, I think we had only seen Dune Part 1 once. And it was just in 2021 on a massive IMAX screen with our favorite guest, James Steck.
Yeah.
And after we saw it, we talked for a long time outside because we were all very conflicted. We were like, okay, that was an epic visually, an epic in its soundscape. But it also felt provocative, like a smarter Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith, like a smarter deconstruction of Anakin Skywalker. And so we were shocked by how impressive that was, the scale, not just in its storytelling, but just in its visuals. And at the same time, we were emotionally distant.
Yeah.
I think all three of us were pretty indifferent. And it was hard to tell if that was because the story wasn't fully realized or the characters weren't fully developed, or if it was just like overwhelming lore. And so getting ready to go watch it again and getting ready for this podcast, I actually was kind of worried for this episode. And because I knew we didn't love Dune before a month ago. And I knew we could talk about, you know, the familiar epic space opera of it all, like the feuding houses competing over resources.
Sure.
There was a lot to unpack about religion as a tool to understand how government and businesses are corrupted. That's all in the film, in the first experience that we had. There's a lot to talk about through that connection, I guess, politically to the movie and the overwhelming sensory experience of it all. But we just were so distant from the characters, and it felt like the movie was hollow when I thought back on Dune. And so when we rewatched this a month ago, a completely different experience. But does that sound right in 2021? Did you have a similar feeling where you're like, I don't know if I connect to this. It's not in my top five Villeneuve. Like that's how I thought about it.
Yeah, I think I liked it more than you and James when we walked out of the movie because I really appreciated the Blade Runner scope again, like of flying over the Capitol and seeing Caladan. Like,
yes.
I think just the scale was so impressive to me, but I did feel distant. I think that's the best way to put it. And I couldn't figure out what I thought at the time was just that I can't get past seeing Timothy Chalamet on the screen.
Sure.
Like, this is starring Paul Atreides. I just see Timmy. And then also, I think I, at that time, thought there was like a pacing issue. It felt like I really wanted to spend more time in Caladan and also like on Arrakis once the Atreides family gets there.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it felt like that was really fast forwarded. And then we spent a lot of time in the desert.
Yeah.
Now I don't feel that way. And I think it's more so that I didn't understand the lore. So I didn't have like, I didn't even understand the stakes of some of the plot points that were happening. And so rewatching it in preparation for this podcast, knowing the stakes, like knowing that Jessica was actually afraid that Paul could die in a scene, I genuinely did not pick up. And so having, I wish we did see it like two or three times. So I really could appreciate it.
Or like Oscar Isaac's looks in the background when he like, there is somebody from the Fremen community who's speaking with Paul and Oscar Isaac's making these faces suggesting that he doesn't really know what's going on, but he can tell something's going on.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, am I going to die soon? Like, so that really rewards on rewatch. Yeah, so our rewatch of it a month ago, we'll get to that in a second, but we were like, okay, this is epic. We both looked to each other an hour in. We're like, yeah, this movie rocks. Yeah. I think there were three issues for me in 2021 when we saw this. And I tried to narrow this down. One, my own bias. I love Blade Runner 2049. Mm-hmm. And we both do.
Yeah.
And I think I was always really irked that 2049 never got its due. And Dune felt like this adjacent step for my relationship to Villeneuve's movies in terms of atmosphere over plot. And sometimes by accident, like atmosphere can lead to, unfortunately, like hollow images over narrative. And I thought Dune maybe was even a step down because Blade Runner was so layered in what it was doing cinematically. And even in his like socio-political vision with Dune, I was like, okay, we've already seen this in Blade Runner. Like 2049 didn't get, it felt like 2049 was being lost to history as I was watching Dune.
Yeah, and that's fair. Yeah.
And I think that might've been a part of my experience with it. That's me personally though. As for the second issue, going to what you were just saying, I thought technically there were pacing issues. There was editing choices that felt abrupt. There were acting problems in that moment. And maybe it was, again, more me, which is that I saw Chalamet and I didn't see Paul. And it never felt right to see this guy who looks like he's Gen Z / millennial on screen in this, like, you know,
space,
I guess 20,000 years from now in space. Yeah. And Zendaya and her like nonverbal expressions can only do so much for me. And so we only get so much of her too, like 5 minutes of screen time, not even. And yeah, I feel like I also had this weird relationship to the movie. Like, oh, is Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac going to be in this movie the whole time? Oscar Isaac's killed halfway through and you're kind of like, wait, what? And Stellan Skarsgård was great, but I was like, something doesn't feel right about this movie in terms of the world's lore. The exposition was really repetitive. I remember thinking, why does everything have to be explained in this? So I remember overthinking the movie a lot the first time I watched it because so much is going on. Mm-hmm. And I think I misplaced my own sensory overload with this idea that the movie had flaws in its design and its performances. And then on rewatch,
I would say me too.
I just didn't feel those things at all. So my first two issues from 2021 about part one aren't even like real issues that I have anymore after revisiting it multiple times. Like we've seen it like 5 or 6 times now in the past few weeks for prep for this episode. And I think the lasting issue in Dune Part 1 is probably a even bigger problem in Dune Part 2, but I say problem lightly because the movies are so self-aware of it, which is that there is this under-discussed, though now is starting to be more discussed, use of Arab culture throughout the entire film, both films, and a kind of purposeful co-opting of a westernized idea of Arab culture and also Muslim iconography in the film in so many moments in both movies. And the 2021 movie tries to capitalize on this Western ignorant monolithic idea of what Arab culture or even Muslim culture in some cases is to the West. And I think that's a really complicated vision for Villeneuve, who he has talked about this in different ways. And it's complicated on multiple levels. First off, Dune is using cultural appropriation as a critique on cultural appropriation. And that is a really challenging, difficult theme to get across because you have to like really perfectly balance that idea and really fully develop things. And sometimes not everything is developed in these movies. And when it comes to that theme, and from what Villeneuve has said in press over the past few years, he has tried to use stereotypes in both Dune movies as intentional to try and expose the audience in the Western world's bubble to Eastern cultures and specifically the Middle East and North Africa. And Paul in the novels and in the movie is kind of supposed to be this surrogate for the audience in this foreign world to us that has been Westernized, which I think is really subversive filmmaking, you know, to do in this epic that is normally in the hands of another filmmaker would have been an action movie.
Yeah.
Playing into stereotypes definitely, rather than addressing them.
Yeah. I think the best way to maybe compare what he's trying to do and being subversive is like, if we think of the male gaze in Blade Runner toward Ana de Armas's character, right, as Joy, and trying to make a statement about like the objectification of women in capitalism and like in patriarchy with that character. He's trying to make a comment on like the colonial gaze in Western media and narratives in Dune. And I think it is like very complicated, and I don't think it's always successful. especially in, yeah. in Dune Part Two. But I do think that like in maybe the first one, it's more clear what he is trying to do.
It's very,
I guess in the second one, he's pretty explicit about it too.
After watching it three times, it's still realized like it's there. But the problem with the movie is that it's really left up to the audience and their media literacy to a certain mm-hmm. extent. And you know, that's not always true. And we'll talk about a few specific examples in a second. But you do kind of risk this massive subversive epic of trying to provoke the audience at this high level of their own ignorance. You do risk perpetuating stereotypes, and unfortunately Part Two has a couple moments of that.
I agree.
Something Villeneuve and his studio can't really explain as a meta reading of the films is that the movies don't hire any, if at all, except for a few actors in the periphery, like Middle Eastern or West Asian or North African people in its lead cast. And I know Hollywood, like Americanizing Eastern culture, is usually because they're trying to get a movie greenlit. So like Hollywood has traditionally hired white or white-coated celebrities to get financing. So even with characters that are non-white in Dune, you can see that there was a pressure from the studio to hire actors who are the best return on investment. Like obviously Zendaya as Chani or Javier Bardem as Stilgar. These actors are being asked to play Arab-coded characters. And that is because of the business of it all. Mm-hmm. And so that's complicated too. And I think moviegoers and critics aren't really criticizing that part of this as much. That seems like an element of this that could have been easily, like, I feel that after two Dune movies, I've been in this world for 5 hours, right? 5+ hours. It would have been nice to meet or a new character, like a Fremen character in like an intimate, healthy way that doesn't seem like it would have felt forced. I feel like we could have met Fremen characters, and the movies do try to do that, especially in Part Two, but it's never fully realized for any of the side characters.
Yeah. And I don't think that it would be like going out of the story. I know that the story is focused on Paul and it's trying to deconstruct this idea of Paul again as this Messiah figure and his power and how like the audiences in the past have sympathized with his type of character and trying to really like challenge the audience in that way. But that doesn't mean that just because it's a story about Paul that we couldn't have spent more time with the Fremen, especially in Part Two.
Yeah.
And gotten like, even like Zendaya's character, a lot of people are saying this is Zendaya's movie. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. If it were her, actually her movie, which I think would be great, we would get more than just her connection as like a partner for Paul.
That is such a weird reading of Dune Part Two that it's Chani's movie. Like it's like, just because we're spoilers at this point, but just because the movie ends with her image does not mean it's her film. It's just like the end of the first movie. It's commenting on maybe the trilogy is going to end with Chani as the quote unquote protagonist. But that does not mean it's her film. So yeah, that's interesting. In terms of some examples, just so we're telling listeners, like I don't want listeners who are obsessed with science fiction to get annoyed with what we're talking about, because a lot of sci-fi fans are like, hey, this is like set in the future, so what you're saying doesn't really matter. And just because this movie is set 20,000 years into the future where cultures and religions are blended, and that was what the author of these novels tried to do. I'm aware of that. Like, we're both aware of that. But Western writers have been playing in fantasy and science fiction for a long time just so they can make things sometimes that are seemingly inoffensive, and they get to play in realms where they normally would be held to a responsibility or an accountability that because they're in sci-fi, they don't necessarily have. They don't have to be accountable for their motivations or actions. Obviously, the Herbert novels have been acclaimed because of what they're trying to do to provoke white Western audiences of their ignorance, and that's why they're special, and the movies are doing the same thing. But hopefully nobody's like, not my sci-fi when listening to this, because
not my Dune.
This conversation does matter. It's a difficult conversation, but it does matter, because the movies are critiquing, again, cultural appropriation while also sort of appropriating in a moment. For example, we have the score by Hans Zimmer that was incredibly immersive.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was deeply unsettling, not just in terms of like the intention of trying to create a horror tension filled scene, but also unsettling because it plays with these vaguely religious and almost like westernized ideas of Eastern cultures, sounds and singing that makes the score sometimes feel orientalist.
Yes.
And that's one big complicated part of this. And again, some of that is intentional, again, because Villeneuve has talked about wanting to play with the audience's idea of the ways that they've been stereotyping other cultures around the world so that they feel comfortable in the movie, like they're in a film they've already seen before, to then twist it on them at the end.
Yeah, I would say that I understand when he's doing that visually or with characters because he's able to overlap dialogue where he's explicitly telling us that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
But with the music specifically, like I think it was just a bad choice. It is like you said, right? It's a form of Orientalism, like through the sound, where it's othering like cultures because Paul Atreides is our main character.
Yeah. I mean, it's not every part of the score. It's just a few of the composed themes for some of the characters.
Yeah.
Feels off considering what the movies are about in that moment. And then you have performances like Javier Bardem, who is one of the great actors as Stilgar. And in part one, he's such an interesting stoic leader that has like this dark sense of humor. But in part two, he has been like literally reduced to getting these like cheap Borat level laughs from the audience that are like feel bad laughs. And he uses these like accent choices to create this like wacky, dopey caricature of an old fundamentalist man from the quote unquote what America would think of as the Middle East. And then they dress him also in the stereotypical Arab garment, as all of the Fremen are. But like it makes it all feel like you're watching a different movie. Again, this is something that Villeneuve has talked about as like an intentional choice, because by the end, the movie is trying to get you to think about Stilgar's character and how tragic it is that he's been colonized and how he's just been trying to liberate his people while the movie's been trying to get the audience to laugh at him.
Right.
Yeah. Which is key for the subversion of the movie's themes.
Yeah, and I think it's layered because there are moments, I guess, when the audience is getting the joke that Denis is actually trying to make intentionally with Stilgar's character in terms of like the as written right line repeated over and over again, because he's trying to make a comment about like dogma in general, right, and religion as an ideology for control.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is that Denis doesn't like connect. And this could be like a, you know, also like a textual problem from the original Dune.
Yeah.
But still, like if you're adapting it, then there's a responsibility of like connecting dogma and religion across the Imperium, or having audiences maybe be a little bit more challenged in that sense. Because if you think about it, like the Bene Gesserits, right, are dogmatic in the same way, but they are using or are able to use religion as a tool to steer the Imperium from the shadows, right? And I don't know if audiences are leaving Dune thinking about, oh, okay, like here's how religion operates as a tool, like for example, like in the United States with Christianity. Like I don't know if audiences are really walking away with that.
Yeah, some people might just be walking away from this film as an action film that does a good enough job as a critique of the white messiah narrative. But Denis Villeneuve's ultimate goal for these two films is pretty obvious, and he's been clear about this in different interviews throughout the past few years. And this has been a goal of him through a lot of his movies. And in fact, a lot of this religious symbolism is through Prisoners or Blade Runner. It's in other films he works on. But he wants to try to expose the Western audience's role in imperialism and colonialism. And he tries to do that through getting them to reflect on how they are Paul, or the Western audience is like a Paul figure, as somebody who is othering cultures, who maybe thinks they know more about a culture than the people who actually live in that culture. And he wants to get Western audiences to reflect on their own role in the Imperium, or their own role in maybe conveniently not knowing the power of the Bene Gesserit in their own country. And like that's like our country and Christianity and Catholicism. And like, obviously our country's support of Israel right now, what's happening to Palestinians. And like, that is so obvious. That is so obviously on the forefront of the ideas of Dune 1 and Dune 2. But I've seen a lot of the praise of this movie stop at, wow, just a better Anakin Skywalker story, like a better white messiah story. It's critical of like white hero narratives and white savior narratives, while also being like a sick action movie.
Right.
And I don't know if that just means it's going to take time for people to kind of pick up on the deeper themes and about how this movie's kind of indicting a Western audience.
Yeah.
Or if it's happening in the moment, like people are going to watch this multiple times over this weekend. Like there's been, I think, record sales from this past year or two of people going back to see a movie twice. And so that might just come with, you know, a few weeks, few months, hopefully not years.
Yeah. Well, when we talk about our kind of reactions to Dune 2, since we've seen it three times now, I literally had a different reading three different times.
Yeah.
And now I actually feel like I have a handle on what Denis was doing because I, you know, it's obviously massive. And so yes. I missed just even like a few crucial points of dialogue that really tell us what he's intending.
Yeah.
And so I definitely want to talk about that, but we should probably talk about our re-experience with Dune Part One, right?
Yes. So these were all of our observations after revisiting Dune Part One multiple times over this past month, watching Dune Part Two three times. And so we understand Denis Villeneuve's vision now, but back when we saw Dune Part One in 2021, we were a little bit skeptical of the lore of Paul. And we were a little bit confused, to be honest. But now I think after the IMAX reissue a month ago, we totally understood what Villeneuve was going for, and it's really successful.
Yeah.
And I wasn't just impressed by the themes or the politics of Dune, just by how transportive its atmosphere was. I was so impressed by the film. It was kind of shocking cinematically how we both were being impacted by the same scenes. I think there was like one scene when we were an hour in where I looked over to you and we had like a Portrait of a Lady on Fire moment where you were you were already looking at me.
Yeah.
Kind of having this moment together being like, oh, do we love this film?
Is this an amazing movie?
Yeah. And so the scope and scale got us, you know, and I was also kind of floored by the fine-grained detailing of this intergalactic cautionary tale about empire building just in like a visual filmmaking and suggestive non-dialogue, like non-verbal things that were going on in the backgrounds with characters. And I was just taken by the vastness and the storytelling and the staggering Shakespearean mystery of it all. Like the fall of Duke Leto, is it Leto?
I think so, yeah.
Really, really hit this time. Like when you're seeing naked Oscar Isaac lying there across from Skarsgård, the Baron Harkonnen, I was devastated because you're kind of invested in this family as this kind of like Neo-Athens, this republic trying to build themselves up from like being a part of this oppressive empire. And I was kind of bought into like this character believing in his own kind of bullshit. And I was like tearing up by Duke Leto dying. And that wasn't there for me the first time I watched this movie. And there was this emotional depth in the Atreides family dynamic that I just didn't get the first time around.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, I think it might be Leto. Leto.
Guys, honestly, like, it's a made-up character. I think we're okay. It's fine.
Okay, I'm going to say Leto, just like Jared Leto.
Jared Leto? Okay.
But yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think the thing that really got me on the second watch, like, you know, because we had only seen it in 2021 and then now a few months ago for Dune Part One, was the idea that, like, I feel emotionally connected to Leto's character because of the family drama of it all with his attachment to, like, Timothy Chalamet and Paul. And we're following this family. But ultimately, like, what you were saying even more so is what I feel like we understood what Dune was, with the commentary of Dune, right? Like,
yeah, the religious power broking dynamic,
right,
of it all.
The political, like, stakes of Dune. And so, like, you know, Oscar Isaac talking about, like, basically working with the Fremen, you, like, see how, like, delusional he is as a character, of him trying to be, like, this good person as a king figure, as a duke. So I think that was really interesting on rewatch, and I'm excited to talk more about that today and kind of the shifts in his character and how the audience reacts to him, how the story's playing with the audience's expectations.
There's multiple levels. You realize how strategic Lady Jessica is while also like really loving her family. You realize how delusional the Duke is about his own kind of impact on the Fremen people and how he views them, you know, just aesthetically as humans, like just through his language, but he's still exploiting these workers and this planet and these people, and how it's like a faux alliance and how he really wants to like co-opt quote unquote desert power.
And so cringy.
That really, I know, that really works. And then you also see on rewatch, on multiple rewatches, you can kind of see Denis planting the seeds of, maybe he told Chalamet, because I don't think Chalamet read the whole book by the time they finished the first film, but how Paul was going to be this virtue signaling teenager to then becoming this charismatic populist turned fascist. And you can kind of see the beginnings of that in this film in subtle ways, even in ways, in layered ways, where you think Paul is being a quote unquote good, wealthy, royal, rich prince.
Yeah.
But in reality, he's just, you know, a good person in terms of like the surface of his actions. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, it was just a really like layered experience that I did not get my first time around. And so I'll give you a great example of my Dune fandom shift, and then we can get to our reactions for Dune Part 2. But Part 1 ends with Zendaya's final fifth minute or whatever of screen time. She's only in the first movie for like 5-6 minutes, whatever it is, which was disappointing. But she looks back at Paul and Jessica as Paul and Jessica are watching a Fremen person ride a sandworm. And Zendaya's character, Chani, delivers the pretty corny line of, "This is just the beginning,"
right,
with like music playing in the background, with Timmy kind of smiling at her. And this really kind of like, they're supposed to be playing teenagers, so this very teenage look. And the Dune music's going crazy at this point. And then Lady Jessica's in the background, like ominously going from a fake smile to then this like strategizing, disappointed face.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, when we were sitting with James the first time in 2021, what the hell is this movie? Like, what am I watching right now? Is this even a real film? Is this a fake Messiah movie? Is this just kind of like table setting for something that's going to come, you know?
Yeah, and it felt confused. Very much like a Part 1 incomplete film, especially with a such on the nose, you know, dialogue point of this is just the beginning. I remember being so disappointed by that when we first watched it.
Right. And then Denis, you know, has said that Part 1 is like obviously Part 1 of an entire project. And so after I heard that, I was like, okay, I guess when rewatching it, I'll try to remember from that perspective. But on this rewatch in the IMAX reissue, when she says, "This is just the beginning," I was like, let's go.
Yeah, exactly.
I was so Dune pilled that I was like, yeah, this is just the beginning. It's going to get crazier from here. You're right. And I just, it's funny because I still think the worms are corny.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the Shakespearean language that they all use is corny. And like, it's all been done before. But Denis kind of playing with that. Even with when Chani says this is just the beginning, Denis is playing with this idea that we've lived in a world that we've rewatched epic movies like Aliens or whatever multiple times, where they're using over the top language. And so, yeah, I loved rewatching Dune 1, and I got so excited for Dune 2.
Me too. Yeah.
So Dune 2.
Okay.
We've seen Dune Part 2 3 times. We're still in reaction mode. Like listeners know, we try not to talk to each other off mic too much about new movies so we can wait for the podcast. So I'm curious to see. I mean, you've kind of already revealed that you loved Part 1 more.
Yeah.
And I think I agree, but it's still so soon. We've only had a week to think about it. And Dune Part 2 is a really special theater experience. And I hate saying that because the movie just came out and I don't want to be a part of the hype train around any new release. But this is quite the spectacle. And even though it has its issues, and we've already talked about a lot of those, I do think there are reasons why people are saying it's the best sequel since The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
I think there are justifications for saying like this is the best sequel since The Two Towers, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Or
I guess Empire Strikes Back, but that's such a big take. It's just such a grand scale blockbuster that I get it. The first time we watched it, I think we should go through each time as the best way to do this as a reaction.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, you tell me, and then I'll tell you my three different reactions.
Should we go like time by time, like movie, like our first time to our second time?
No, I want to do mine in a row because otherwise I'll lose track.
Okay, fair enough. The first time I saw Dune Part 2, I was overwhelmed just like the first time. And I thought the white savior critiques were obviously very clear. The crossover of religion, politics, and business were clear to me, of like the Bene Gesserit kind of running the Imperium and also controlling the spice trade to a certain extent. The exposing of populism as the step toward fascism through Paul and the way he treats the Fremen, that was clear in the first movie, though I had a lot of questions still. And then that all kind of leading to radicalism or fundamentalism. Some of that was overtly clear, where like characters were calling other characters fundamentalists like 4 or 5 times throughout the film.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I see why Denis's doing this. He's like anxious or worried that people are not going to get what he's trying to do here.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had like big plot questions, which I know might sound annoying to listeners, but it was like a two hour, 45 minute epic that I felt like was unnaturally paced in some moments and edited in some moments. And I didn't structurally understand where the movie was going, or I didn't understand the clear motivations of some characters. And so I thought Denis was like playing with form and narrative. So I was like, I need to see this again, because maybe he was being experimental with editing. Maybe we're jumping you know, a lot of months or something. I was just very confused about the timeline.
Similar to our experience with the first one, we didn't understand the story. So yeah, it was like, you know, where are we going? Like feeling that way, or was that a full encapsulation like of the story?
Yeah. Did he do the narrative justice, I guess? Was he too obsessed with the scope and scale? And I guess I was like, was he too interested in the worms at the end? Like,
I definitely felt like I had to rewatch it. I mean, I loved it the first time, but I did feel that way too.
I was wowed by the fight, and I've shifted on the fight since, and we'll talk about that in a second.
Oh, okay.
And there were some story conceits too, like the poison and Paul's shift to like this vengeful boy. And I was kind of confused by that too, in terms of like him now saying he wants to avenge his father. And I was like, where did that come from? Okay, so that was my first watch. On second watch, that shift of Paul's character was actually pretty genius, especially after rewatching the first film a lot in prep. All the ideas were planted about him becoming this aggressive, dangerous sociopath who is crippled, not because he's evil, but he's crippled by like his coming of age privilege and his coming of age trauma of like losing his father and his house, essentially, which you can only have so much sympathy. It's a prince, but people get the point. So his arc makes sense. However, on second watch, I was still like, all this Lady Jessica stuff with the poison water and the sandworms, I'm still confused about that. And speaking to the fetus and like all of that was jarring. It looked cool visually. It just was jarring. And then I also didn't totally believe in this Chani falling for Paul romance, and it was kind of corny in some moments. And then the third time I watched it, I completely, you know, I thought the movie was great.
Yeah.
And I thought that the appropriation stuff we were talking about before was like obviously intentional, and some of that's underdeveloped, and we can get into specifics on our deep dive. Those criticisms remain. But Villeneuve playing with the conventions of studio action films, studio romances, studio political thrillers. And at the end of this film, I was left feeling like, oh, none of this like interpersonal or like political family melodrama really matters. All this drama and like internal conflict of these characters are secondary or almost like a distraction from the greater point, I think, of the franchise, which is that the Reverend Mother tells Jessica at the end of the movie that there are no sides.
Yeah.
And that power continues to shift between royal families through the rise and fall of empires, and that these are like cyclical rises and falls that are structured and manufactured in such a way that no matter what, there is a royal bloodline at the top of hierarchies across empires, across different cultures, since the beginning of ancient civilizations, which is why the Atreides, I think, come from the Greeks or the Mycenaeans and Minoans. And I think that idea at the end of this movie of Austin Butler and Timothy Chalamet fighting, having a knife fight, and it meaning kind of nothing for the greater point of like how power moves from
either
house
way, the
to Harkonnens house
will be in power.
Exactly. And I think that's a far more genius level provocation than anything else that's going on in the movie about white savior deconstructions or pseudo messiahs, because that stuff is successful in the movie, but it's been done before. I think Villeneuve takes it a notch farther in a little bit even more complex way with, well, what you're watching actually has no stakes, to the point where, like, does it matter if Paul dies? Does it really matter if Austin Butler's character gets killed? And I thought those were fascinating questions to have at a movie that's an action epic, you know, that should not be asking those questions to the audience. It should just be like entertaining them so they can go home and think they had a nice experience. But it's so anticlimactic at the end in such an interesting way.
Yeah. It's like when we see, you know, massive battles between two like countries in a war film, this movie, you know, Dune is kind of talking about the illusion of like morality in that. It's really just like the preservation of power.
Exactly.
And that's why Dune is so special. I totally agree. And to the point where you're right, it's like, well, this fight, like, it goes so quickly because it doesn't matter if the, like, right, either way the Harkonnens are going to be in power, like,
right,
if Timmy dies or not,
right?
And
but he shoots it seriously, like the scene is taken so serious. The choreography, excellent.
Yeah,
the acting, phenomenal.
So good. Yeah,
like
that
everybody
flip, that, like,
you can hear a
horizontal
pin drop in the
flip that Timmy does.
Yeah, I mean, whoever did it, it was really sick.
Like, not Timmy,
man. Chalamet's been working out.
Sorry,
he took
shout
that Duncan
to the,
Idaho shit
to the
seriously.
Stunt guy, but they made it look great. Like, they made it look like he did it. But so I think that is similar to my journey.
Okay.
And like a great a great kind of like take as far as what the movie's larger message is. But here is my experience. Okay. So viewing one, I was like, I'm not sure if audiences or even like me, like if I fully understood what Denis was trying to do with Paul's character or like what the text was doing with Paul's character, but I'm going to say Denis because it's his movie, his adaptation.
Sure.
Where I was like, okay, I see ultimately that Paul chooses power, but is he kind of this reluctant hero? Is the movie as clear as it should be about using the Fremen people to take over the empire?
Right.
And so I left being like, this is interesting in talking about how power operates, like ultimately at the end and religion, but I don't know if it fully accomplished its goal. That was first viewing. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't think that anymore though. Second viewing, I was like, oh, I was totally wrong. At the very beginning of the movie, they repeat what Paul also says in part one, that when they get to the siege in part two, him and Jessica are eating, right? And he's looking at everyone in the siege and he says, I need to convince the non-believers that I am the chosen one.
Yes.
So that way I can get revenge and kill the emperor so I can avenge my dad. And Jessica says, your dad was not a vengeful person. And he says, well, I am.
I am.
Yeah.
Like, oh shit. All right.
And then you see, oh, okay. Well, they clearly told us like what Paul's ambition is, the motivation behind his choices, right? He's not this like, he's not this person who's going up to people. Like when he goes up to Zendaya and her friends and says, yeah, like, oh, what are you guys laughing about? Right. It's this cute Timmy scene, but really right, what he's doing is trying to, again, sway non-believers to not maybe believe in him as the chosen one, but to kind of accept him as a leader.
Yes.
And yeah, so like even when
Johnny.
Jessica.
Okay.
When she takes the poison and becomes the Reverend Mother and he says, no, like Zendaya's right. Right. Chani's right. That Jessica, my mom, like has Bene Gesserit training so she can survive poison. Mm-hmm. And I'm also not the chosen one. Right. All those things are in line with his goal to ultimately sway non-believers.
Yes.
Okay.
Totally.
And so I was like, okay, that makes more sense. And it was clear all along what Paul's motivations were. And then it just really like hammers it home in the end when it makes an even bigger statement about it doesn't even matter if Paul prevails because ultimately right, like power is just going to function in this cycle under this like galactic
group of houses,
empire system
that are all cross-pollinated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But in the second viewing, I was still thinking like, is it though still a little bit too sympathetic to Paul because there's this middle section of the movie where it kind of frames it as him becoming quote unquote, like one of the Fremen, right?
Right.
Like he gets his name Usul and he's like accepted and he yells at his mom that what she did and what the Bene Gesserit did to the Fremen people and to Arrakis.
It's not a prophecy. It's a story.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, was it still too like sympathetic to his character where it wouldn't really like challenge audiences and bring the point home as clear as it could? That was my second viewing. Okay.
That's very similar to my experience. I'm sure that's relatable.
Third viewing. Okay. And this is why I love the movie. Third viewing, I picked up on the same things. Okay. At the very beginning, he tells us, I need to sway the non-believers. Then in the middle, he does actually love Chani and he does like consider the Fremen people and like people he meets his friends.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I don't think it's a sympathetic kind of like note for Paul's character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the biggest thing that I missed was the vision right before he takes the poison.
Yes. Yeah.
And the reason that it's so important is because in that like kind of voice that's talking to him throughout both Dune movies.
This is the most important shift, by the way, in the movie. This is when he decides, I'm going down south.
Yes.
Right.
When he says like to Zendaya, I'm going to go down south and do what needs to be done.
Which is the most questionable part of the movie. It's where I think it's losing the most people. Like it's going to lose. Because that's where it lost me on multiple watches until the third watch.
Because of the momentum, I think. But for me, not because of like what the actual plot shift is.
Okay.
So the reason I think that this is like the most important part of the movie in terms of the message and Paul's character is there's the voice that comes through and says, hey, to be the chosen one, you have to drink the juice, like drink the blue juice,
yeah,
the poison. so you can see everything, right? And he knows that, like, if he drinks the poison, he'll become the chosen one. Mm-hmm. He'll complete the prophecy. And the reason that that's important is because he's going to kill millions or billions of people, right, in this holy war. And he chooses to take the poison knowing already, before even, you know, quote unquote, seeing everything, that he will bring, like, genocide and bring death and starvation to the entire empire. And he chooses it anyway because he ultimately wants to get revenge and take control of the empire.
A lot of that subversion is a credit to Timmy as a performer, because he plays Paul, even so, in the first,
like,
half,
gentle,
saying kind of awful things under his breath that if you unpack are, like, really kind of sociopathic. But he's saying everything with such a calm demeanor, almost warm sometimes. And I think even Shani tells her friend that she sees him as
sincere,
right? And that is how he is coming off, even though he's literally, like, just living and continuing to join the Fremen community, not to quote unquote save them, but because his house was massacred.
Or how he frames it, like, help liberate them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's interesting because it's fascinating that Denis is trying to, like, contextualize the Fremen and jihad as a liberating act, which is phenomenal in terms of studio filmmaking. Like, he's contextualizing the Fremen as wanting to liberate themselves. And this is where Chani comes in and is like, a Fremen needs to save the Fremen community, not you, like, not Paul.
And
she tells him multiple times. He even tries to, like, sneak it in a couple times when they're, like, in the tent together, right, like, after they've already made a relationship. And she's like, you're still not a Fremen. He's like,
maybe
though.
Yeah.
Like, no. That's all really smart filmmaking. You really pick it up by the third time.
But that's why I actually think this movie's great. I think it does deliver on its messages and themes that it sets out to. And I genuinely think I just, like, missed certain plot points. Also, that's, like, probably on me. I was, you know, like, whispering to you the whole time. I wasn't being obnoxious.
It's a lot.
I wasn't, like, talking during the movie, everyone. Yeah. But I was just like, LOL Austin Butler, and, like,
sure.
But yeah, so I missed a few things. I think that those plot points are so important. Those shifts that I just noted in my third viewing that I picked up on the beginning, even though it's, like, sort of, it could be read as sympathetic towards Timmy's character, I don't think it actually is trying to do that. And I think that's important.
So it's not sympathetic to Timmy's character, but it is sympathetic to the idea of cycles when it comes to pain, which is something that Denis comes back to over and over again. In Prisoners is the most obvious case, which is, like, how inflicting pain on others comes in cycles. And Prisoners is a post 9/11 movie, and he tells that theme through Hugh Jackman's character. And I definitely think that's something he's doing through Timmy, which is that the Imperium committed genocide to the House of Atreides. And now Timmy, as a response, is going to commit genocide to all of the houses, or at least that's what's being set up, I guess. We don't know what's going to happen. But that seems like what they're literally telling us now for two movies in a row, is that there's going to be a holy war and billions of people are going to die. So we could disagree with the politics of the third movie. We just don't know Dune Messiah, the story. We haven't read it. We're not going to be honest. I'm just going to watch the movie and see what happens. I don't want to spoil it for myself. But in terms of these first two films, I do think Denis Villeneuve and the collaborators on this movie did a fantastic job of deconstructing the white savior myth, the white hero narrative myth, and did a good job of provoking audiences. And we'll see how that will age throughout the years. I also think he did a great job of unpacking the Bene Gesserit and their relationship to the Imperium, and vice versa, and the spice trade and the monopoly over spice and the colonialism aspects, the imperialism aspects. That's all great. The only question I really have going into the third film is how much of the story will we see through the Fremen?
Yeah.
And specifically Chani, because the movie ends on Chani's face going onto a sandworm, or about to.
Yeah. Because I feel like that is something that's lacking in both movies, but specifically the second one, because we're spending so much time with the Fremen, but we're mainly seeing the Fremen characters in their relationship to Paul.
Yes.
Like, we don't really get to know the characters as much as I think we should.
Right. Definitely not, which makes it Dune Part 2 a little bit confusing, because you're spending so much time in the North and South, and you're like, I'd like to know more about the differences between the North and the South, except aside from the North thinking the South are fundamentalists. Like, for example, Dr. Liet Kynes, who we'll talk about today, assuming she's from the North, because mm-hmm. of her trying to terraform and trying to help create technology that will bring water to Arrakis.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah, like that stuff will be interesting or would have been interesting. But I guess that's a part of the tragic ending of Dune Part 2, which is that the Fremen leave, or so many of the Fremen leave Arrakis, led by Paul.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Dr. Liat Kynes today in our Dune 1 deep dive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, before we get into that, our Dune Part 2 deep dive is still coming. We still didn't talk about so much.
There's
like, we
so
have
much
to talk about
yeah.
Austin Butler's character, the Ridley Scott influences, like yeah. the Gladiator, but also like other parts of the Prometheus influences.
Yes.
And like Florence Pugh's in
Ferguson's
this movie.
Great.
Yeah.
Anya Taylor-Joy plays a fetus.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, we'll talk
Voices
about that.
One. Yeah. Yeah, it's confusing.
And the Bene Gesserits, like
yeah.
the knife fight at the end. Like, there's so much still to talk about with
the
Dune 2
pieces.
That I'm excited about.
Yeah.
But that will be coming. We're doing Dune Part 1 right now.
Right now. So, as always, our Extra Credits Plus episodes are deep dives, but they are also live commentaries. Mm-hmm. So we will be discussing Dune Part 1 while watching it. If you're on the main feed, if you're a new listener, that means you're listening to the first probably hour of this episode, because we'll put the reaction out for everyone to hear it. You can find our deep dive of Dune Part 2 on the main feed in the next few days. But you can go to the description on this episode right now, and you'll find our Patreon called the Extra Credits Plus, where you can join us on Living Plus to get access to the full however long this episode's going to be yeah. today, which might be 4 hours. And we publish like 2 to 3 3+ hour deep dives on there. We've covered some of the best films ever made: Goodfellas, Alien, Blade Runner, 2049, Silence of the Lambs, Phantom Thread, The Social Network, Portrait yeah. of a Lady on Fire.
Wow.
There is a lot to choose from. So for any listeners who want to listen and watch along, you can stream Dune on Hulu and Max right now, or free on TNT cable, or you can purchase it on 4K, which I recommend, even though visually it will never look how it will look on your IMAX screen in a theater. The sound mix is pretty wild. Kelsey was listening to or watching Dune this morning, and I was upstairs taking notes, and our whole house was shaking as she watched the film. So I recommend that. All right, ready?
Yeah.
Okay, on play. We'll start the movie. 3, 2, 1, play. Okay, so the movie opens up with some words on screen and a Sadarkar voice, which is kind mm-hmm. of frightening. Dreams are messages from the sleep.
From the deep.
From the
also,
deep.
Also, dreams are, I guess, messages from sleep.
That's so funny. My brain could not figure that out.
I would like a second guess. Hi.
Hello there. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. Thank you for listening so far. And hopefully you are enjoying
yeah.
the episode so far. I feel like maybe if you made it this far.
They got it this far. They're yeah. having a good time.
I mean, let's hope. But to access our full conversation, you can go to the description of this episode to join our Patreon community, the Extra Credits Plus.
Yes. And for only $5 a month, you can get access to our full catalog of Patreon exclusive episodes. Hope to see you there.